Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1990 Tony Scott masterpiece, Days of Thunder. Drew, is this on your list?
Yeah, I'll claim it. I mean, this was an idea I came up with when I heard that our father was going to attend a NASCAR race, which seemed to kind of come out of the blue.
Excellent. And you're a avowed Tony Scott fan?
Indeed.
And I think most of us, at least 2/3 of us, are Tom Cruise fans.
Only 2/3?
Jason, are you a Tom Cruise fan?
Yeah, we've talked about this.
All right, yeah, okay.
You're actually the one who was most resistant to liking him.
Yes.
He's like, I don't want to like him, but turns out he's a good actor and I kind of have to like him.
Yeah.
I was like, I like him fine. I think he's batshit crazy, but I like him.
No, now I'm full in. Now I'm fully dipped or steeped in the juices or whatever.
Gross.
And I think we're all big Cary Elwes fans.
You're steeped in the hot garbage juice that this movie is.
Well, hold on.
There are so many amazing things about this movie. And I will say number one amazing thing about this movie is remembering Tom Cruise's original teeth.
Yes.
Also, remembering how short he was to the gigantic redwood that Nicole Kidman is.
Yes.
Yeah, is this where they met?
Yeah. Yeah. He actually saw the movie Dead Calm and wanted her as his love interest in this movie from that performance. God.
Did he manipulate that into happening?
Of course.
Jesus.
Yeah, he's a star. What do you do?
They did 3 movies together?
Yeah, I think so. And it's amazing because in this movie, they had 0 chemistry.
Well, they didn't have any chemistry in Eyes Wide Shut either, did they?
At least she had acting chops in that.
What other movie were they in together?
Far and Away.
Ah.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think she had much to work with in this movie.
Well, no one really did.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Well, okay, so... let's go around the horn and do our first recollection and our most recent thing. And then before we get into the plot though, I've got a journey to take us down, but starting with Drew, since you're going to claim it, when did you see this movie the first time and what did you think? And what do you think of it now?
I saw this movie on TV at some point on one of the cable movie channels that we had in abundance. And in the early 90s, it was just on a lot. So back when I had a lot of free time and access to television, I watched it quite a bit. And it, you know, it has some iconic lines to it. And so lines that you will always remember. And I imagine when we heard that our father was going to attend a NASCAR race, I bet we all replied to him with the same line, individually, at separate times.
Something to do with rubbing his racing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it was... This movie does not make you work very hard. So it's easy to watch, and it's easy to digest. It doesn't really aspire to much, I don't think. And I think it delivers. So I remember liking it. It was on, and it was easy to be on. And so when I watched it this time, I had a similar reaction. I was like, there's a lot of silly in this, maybe unintentionally. But man, a young Tom Cruise still has a ton of star appeal. And there were a lot of interesting things in this movie, like whatever Robert Duvall was opting to do.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that, because this was an odd and oddly enjoyable Robert Duvall performance.
Yeah, and it's under 2 hours, and it wastes no time. Maybe to his detriment, but there's no fat on the bone of this movie.
I would say that it should not have been a minute longer. I think it was fine the way it was, didn't need any other subplots or anything.
There's like a whole other Russ Wheeler movie in there somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But they spent no time on that. It was fine. It was perfectly enjoyable. I mean, there was a montage within the first 15 minutes of this movie.
Oh, yeah. So, I think I echo most of your thoughts, Drew. So, yeah, I think I don't have to talk too much about my reaction. Jason, I sense from your attitude now and some texts that we sent back in a text chain that you maybe had a different experience. Can you describe that for us? Had you seen this movie before?
No. Never. And it was so horrendous that I started watching it two nights ago and had to pull the ripcord halfway through because I had to stop. I just, once Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise were in bed together, I was like, I am done for now. I'm done. I'm walking away. I will come back to this, but this is too far. I will come back to this. But wait,
that scene is how I learned about the concept of drafting.
Okay, can I? I'm going to make an admission here.
Can I finish?
Yeah. No.
Can I finish? Can I finish? Now,
I'm going to let you finish.
Yeah.
I actually just fast forwarded through the sex scene. I had never seen this movie before, and as soon as she turned and said, "Oh, well, I'm interested," or whatever, and pushes it up against the wall, I'm like, nope. trying to on my phone, you know, or my iPod, I'm trying to like scrub over to the to just the next non-sex scene. If there was dialogue about drafting, I had no idea what it was because I just skipped right past it.
You missed the sugar packet example up her leg.
Yeah, I did. Because I was like, this has nothing to my experience. I'm moving on. So maybe I'm just an old man, but...
Also, I thought she was going to like... Ark of the Covenant, like, suck him into the vortex, or she was turning into a velociraptor. I couldn't tell which. One of those two things. Or she was being, like, T-Rexing him up against the wall. I was praying halfway through when Michael Rooker was losing his mind that the zombie apocalypse had started and this was going to cross over into The Walking Dead. That was my prayer.
He was kind of playing the same character.
He kind of was.
I think I know Michael Rooker best, frankly, from his appearance on Doug Love's movies, none of which were sober or even... I mean, he was barely awake. In fact, they played a game where he had to, the idea was to name movies that Michael Rooker had been in, and he did not win that game.
Wow.
Okay, so let's take a little adventure here. Something I found delightful.
Jason finished.
I'm going to let you finish. Go ahead.
Yeah. Never saw this movie before. Had to watch it in two parts because it was a big steamy pile. I don't know that there was a character in here that I even cared about. I was just hoping that they would all like have some big semi crash and die in a fiery wreck so that my agony would have been alleviated. But you know, that's just me.
Actually, here, I'll spoiler here too. There is one character, and of course now I can't think of his name again. I didn't put him in my notes, but, because he's, of course, this is another movie with no IMDb synopsis, so I kind of pieced it together from the Wikipedia plot summary.
Are you going to bring up John C. Reilly?
I am. Okay. It's not the Russ Wheeler story I want to know. It's John C. Reilly's story I want to know about his dad dying.
Yeah, that's fair.
His buck.
Yeah.
His buck.
Or let's bring him back to somebody we all love. We can all agree that we love Siskel and Ebert, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
We love them a little less because they're both dead, but.
Oh, I think it actually makes your heart grow fonder. Because in death, Ebert has a chin again.
Aww.
Too soon.
Bruno was super interested in your awe, by the way.
While reviewing Days of Thunder, Roger Ebert noted the following, and I'll quote here a little bit. Days of Thunder is an entertaining example of what we might as well call the Tom Cruise picture. Since it assembles most of the same elements that work in Top Gun, The Color of Money, and Cocktail, and runs them through the formula once again. Parts of the plot are beginning to wear out their welcome, but the key ingredients are still effective. They include, number one, the Cruise character. In all these movies, the Cruise character is a young and naive, but naturally talented kid who could be the best if he ever could tame his rambunctious spirit. Two, the mentor. An older man who has done it himself and has been there before and knows talent when he sees it and who has faith in the kid, even when the kid screws up because his free spirit has gotten the best of him. Number three, the superior woman, usually older, taller, and more mature than the Cruise character, who functions as a mentor for his spirit while the male mentor supervises his craft. Number four, the craft, which the gifted young man must master. Number five, the arena, in which the young man is tested. Six, the arcana, consisting of the specialized knowledge and lore that the movie knows all about and we get to learn. Number seven, the arc, a journey to visit the principal places where the masters of the craft test one another. Eight, the proto-villain, the bad guy in the opening reels of the movie who provides the hero with an opponent to practice on. At first, the Cruise character and the proto-enemy dislike each other, but eventually, through a baptism of fire, they learn to love one another. Number nine, the villain, the real bad guy who turns up in the closing reels to provide the hero with a test of his skill, his learning ability, his love, his craft, and his knowledge of the arena and the arcana. And number 10, which Siskel and Ebert added later together, where they said one more ingredient to the film is usually the dying friend. The friend or colleague who is sick or dying during the course of the film and presents an emotional challenge for the Cruise character. So right now, we could write our own Tom Cruise movie. Just filling in these. It's like a Mad Libs.
Yeah, I think this was the last one of those, though, right?
Yeah, but isn't it perfect?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why the movie is so watchable, because it's cliche, it's all tropes, but it works out fine.
No, it doesn't. Fine.
He had that run of Top Gun, Color of Money, and Cocktail right in a row. And then he took a break to do Rain Man and Born on 4th of July, and then came back to do this movie, back to that formula.
Hopefully for money.
I'm sure.
Because this movie, they spent a lot of money.
This is a Simpson-Bruckheimer movie, so sure.
Yes, and they spent a lot of, I guess the crew of this movie said they made so much in overtime because they just sat around during most of the mornings while the writers and the director kind of argued a little bit about how things should be shot and which character or which direction the character should go in, and like little script revisions. So they worked very long hours.
What script revisions?
Well,
come
exactly,
on. That's
exactly.
Code for something else. That means they had no script.
I guess, yeah. Well, you know, this movie, Tom Cruise has a co-writing credit in this.
Okay, they definitely had no script. It shows.
So, shall we dive into the plot? Even though I just basically gave most of the plot points here. But then this could be short but sweet.
So do you have any housekeeping?
Well, I hate to say that we're going to Kubo the movie, but it's not making, you know, the Kuboing it would be taking a masterpiece and kind of just skipping over the important bits. This is not that. This is...
I have never so much in my life longed for such a treatment for a movie.
So first we have Cole Trickle, which, by the way, it is never addressed.
that he has a ridiculously stupid name.
Yes.
Like he's got syphilis.
But you know who the name is actually like an homage to, or homage to, I guess? There's a race car driver named Dick Trickle.
Of course.
But Dan.
Do you know the sad story of Dick Trickle?
No.
He died by suicide.
I was going to say he petered out.
Yeah, it's actually very sad. In something that I have experienced on the other end of it, he drove to a cemetery and called the police to say there was going to be a dead body there. And they're like, oh, what do you mean? It's like, there's going to be a dead body here. Whose dead body? Me. And then hangs up. And then they found him. He had a plan. It's very sad. It's been a month. Sorry to bring you down from the heights of the name Dick Trickle to real life. But anyway. Back to the fun movie. Cole Trickle comes out of nowhere. From California, of all places. And he wants to drive NASCAR so he can win the Daytona 500.
I will say, in the opening shots of this movie, it was very evident that this movie was made in a different age. Because you had the opening montage of people who go to NASCAR races, and right in the center of the screen was Confederate flags.
Yes.
Even ones that say, we will rise again.
Did you play your own game of find the person of color?
I did not.
It is a Where's Waldo experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. And actually, the whole thing is, it feels very 80s.
It does.
By the way, Quentin Tarantino thought this was his favorite big budget racing movie. Maybe because he hadn't seen the movie Rush yet, which I haven't seen either, but apparently that's good. But he said it was the movies like the Steve McQueen movies, like Le Mans and those movies, that were like, I guess, AIP pictures back in the days. He said this is the kind of movie they would have been had they had the budget. And he said, you don't think too hard about it, you just enjoy it. And then he said, I wish there were more feet.
Someone enjoys it.
Yeah. So he's recruited by Chevy dealership tycoon Tim DeLand, played by Randy Quaid.
I really don't like Randy Quaid.
Do you remember when he was employable?
I was going to say, I dislike him from his performances in the Vacation movies, but this, he was just playing a regular old guy. Smarmy, for sure. But yeah, he's got chops.
I think the only Randy Quaid movie that I really appreciate is Kingpin.
Yeah, but even then. Yeah.
Because he was a transvestite Amish boy.
What about Parents?
I haven't seen Parents, but I remember it. Oh, I'm sorry. wait. Okay, it's late. I have seen Parents. I don't remember much about it, but I am familiar with the movie, yes.
Very, very smooth.
Perfect.
Anyway.
So, looking at Tom Cruise's IMDb, so it was... He had some stuff before, but Risky Business, All the Right Moves, Legend, Top Gun, The Color of Money, Cocktail, Rain Man, Born on the 4th of July, Days of Thunder, Far and Away, A Few Good Men, The Firm, Interview with the Vampire, Mission Impossible, Jerry Maguire, Eyes Wide Shut. And then that brings you to the 2000 era.
Okay, well, I can say that I have not seen Cocktail. I have not seen Rain Man.
You haven't seen Rain Man?
Nope. I had not seen Days of Thunder. I have not seen Far and Away. I did see The Firm. There was another one in there that I hadn't seen, though, right? Basically, A Few Good Men was where I picked back up on because I didn't like Tom Cruise, remember?
No, right.
So why would I see those movies?
You've seen Cocktail.
No.
Even if you haven't seen it, you've seen it.
Well, I just like I've seen Days of Thunder. Because I saw Color of Money and Top Gun, yeah.
you could be the best, but you're too scared.
Exactly, yeah. So, Tim DeLand, again, Randy Quaid, sort of a smarmy car dealer who wants to have one car and one racer. He brings in former crew chief and car builder Harry Hogg. Is it really something like Hoggy? I forget.
Boss Hogg.
Or is his name really Harry Hogg? We have Cole Trickle and Harry Hogg. Yeah, Chubby Chode is the another one of the guys. And
Norm Pitlick.
Ron Schlong, whatever. So, okay. So Robert Duvall, he has to come out of retirement to lead Cole's pit crew and build the car. Robert Duvall is doing a thing, as Drew mentioned. He is the most, like, aw shucks, will shazam, chicken in the bread pan, picking out dough, hillbilly guy ever.
Well, I also want to say this, though. His style of coaching and mentoring, maybe it's just me, but did it remind you of anybody close to us who might have had opportunity to coach or mentor us in our lifetime?
Shall you elaborate?
I was getting a whole lot of Dad Anderson vibes from the sort of... this is going to sound meaner than I want it to be, but the sort of coaching by way of being an asshole style that Harry brought to it.
Sure.
It really felt very familiar.
Well, you know, it's funny. The legend of Father Anderson actually grows and grows because, especially growing up, in almost every situation, Father Anderson is the subject matter expert.
Sure.
Again, maybe that's just a dad thing, right? Growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
of course.
Yeah. So he comes at it with the subject matter expert. But yeah, I can see the style there. Except hopefully dad doesn't, I mean, and you guys could, maybe he does and I didn't know. He doesn't go in and talk to the cars, does he? Because I could have done without that. When Harry Hogg starts giving a pep talk to the race car.
Well, I think a lot of dad's dialogue was mostly internal, so it's entirely possible.
Okay, there you go. So, blah, blah, blah. Cole has to learn how to drive. And I swear to God, when he and Harry eventually are forced to figure out each other's styles, and Tom Cruise has that admission about why he's not understanding what Harry's saying, I swear to God,
because he doesn't know how to read.
Yes, because I never learned to read.
That's essentially what he said, though.
It is, yeah, totally. Anyway, so the proto villain, of course, is Michael Rooker, who plays Rowdy Burns. Blah blah blah. Rubbin's racing. A lot of rubbin in this movie. I don't know. How often do race cars hit each other on purpose? Maybe a lot. I do not know. This movie would lead you to believe it happens all the time, every lap.
There's no way.
I don't
watch racing, but there's no way. I cannot imagine a governing sports body would just allow a situation where you can just ram the back of other cars and that be okay. Or just jam them into the wall if they try and pass you. It seems very dangerous.
Have you ever been to a hockey game?
I have.
I had to remind myself here. So you think 1990, you know, 30 years later, NASCAR cars would be driving faster on the track and blah, 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 more efficient. More efficient, sure. They're not driving faster. These cars are driving in this movie are driving as fast as any cars today because now they actually have limits. I mean, I think they had limits at the time, but like severe top speed limits just because of crashes and stuff.
Yeah, and way, way different safety measures within the car.
Most definitely, yeah. So, of course, we end up with a big crash. The Firecracker 400 in Dayton. In Daytona. Turns out Dayton and Daytona are whole different cities. I think in different states, too.
Indeed.
And both drivers are seriously injured after being caught in the big one, the big crash.
The big one. That's the only time you're ever going to get Tom Cruise and big one in the same sentence.
You yada yada'd what I thought was actually a really effective scene. That crash scene.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sorry.
the crash scene where... I thought it was shot really effectively, where it showed his perspective about, you know, a crash happening on the racetrack, which I've never thought about this aspect of it, about how he has to drive through a cloud of smoke that completely obscures his vision.
Yeah, at like 200 miles an hour.
Yeah, and I guess what you're supposed to do is just go straight through and not try to avoid anything, because everything should be clearing out of your way.
Yeah, because theoretically everybody should be getting the hell out of the way.
Yeah, so that was actually, I thought, really well done scene.
I thought actually the race scenes were pretty effective in this movie. I mean, there were definitely some scenes that I think there was some speeding up of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But, or slowing down, whatever that effect is. But I know in the lore of this movie, they were, because they actually consulted a whole bunch of NASCAR drivers, and there were NASCAR drivers that came on as assistant, consultants, who were like, well, shoot, why are you paying stuntman? I'll drive this car around. And then they realized what the stuntmen were doing and how little they were getting paid to do it. And they're like, nope, you guys can keep this job. I will go back to racing a real car for real money in a safe way. So they both have massive injuries after this crash. They end up in the hospital together because of, plot reasons. They meet a neurosurgeon or a neurologist or something. It's unclear if she's a surgeon or not. But Dr. Claire Lewicki, played by Nicole Kidman. A very pale, very tall, very Australian-sounding, flat affect Asperger's Nicole Kidman.
I appreciated the fact that they allowed her to keep her accent.
Yeah, it was fine.
And I don't know. I thought she was fine in this movie.
Question for you, because I yada yada'd another scene that I thought you were going to scold me for. And that's the scene before the big crash where they're going from place to place and they get pulled over by the cops.
Yeah.
Was that super cringy in 2019?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so too. Yeah. Hiring a prostitute to prank your friend. It's a little tone deaf. And,
to sexually assault your friend.
Yes. But of course, there's a comic turn where he sexually assaults Nicole Kidman, you know, because he thought that's the same deal. In a very heavy-handed, ham-fisted, yes, Jason's drinking. In a very ham-fisted Tom Cruise comedic turn. By the way, I don't like Tom Cruise the comedian, even today.
This is where you should possibly insert a link or reference to Jonathan Coulton's Tom Cruise Crazy song.
Tom Cruise is so in love with Katie. At least all his people tell him so. And while he thinks that she's a very special lady, it's probably not the way he'd choose to go. But a lifetime of longing looks would cause too much distraction. Good thing that he's not gay anymore. Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big, white, shiny smile. You'd buy expensive shoes. But you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise.
So while these guys are all laid up, Randy Quaid hires hotshot rookie Russ Wheeler, Carrie-always, you know, Wesley, who also was doing a weird accent thing. Was this a period of time where Carrie-always was not allowed to use his real accent? Unlike Nicole Kidman.
I think he was trying to emulate Val Kilmer because he had the hair.
He had to be a Southern guy, right? Because he was a real driver.
I guess, yeah. I see, maybe because of John C. Reilly, and maybe because Carrie always comes off a little bit as a cartoon villain, I was thinking of Talladega Nights. Have you seen Talladega Nights, Jason?
Yes.
Some funny.
Yeah.
Praying to Baby Jesus was funny. Sacha Baron Cohen, who in real life was worried he was going to be killed at Talladega Racetrack.
Well, That's not the first time he's been in peril of life and limit when he's been working on a movie.
He said he's never been scareder.
No.
Even when he was back with, like, the neo-Nazis.
And what was it, the second Borat movie?
Bruno. Bruno was the second. Borat was... There's no two Borat movies.
I don't remember. Yeah, there was the rodeo stuff was difficult to watch.
No, that was Borat, right?
I think it must have been. The poop was Borat, which I... But anyway.
Borat's another movie that doesn't hold up well, except it is so quotable.
It's also still better than this movie.
Blah, blah, blah. We have Wesley who plays the... basically the rest of the movie goes as you would expect. Although, because now we have Into Wesley as the real bad guy. And then somehow, did I miss an important scene before the Randy Quaid, giving another engine to Robert Duvall? That was a surprise, right?
Like, we missed so many scenes. We missed the scene where Rowdy and Cole became BFFs. No, there's no scene.
Okay, yeah.
There's no scene. This movie could not be bothered with scenes like that.
And yet they took the time, which I thought was good, to have the scene where they both rent cars and race them across town, smashing them up. Apparently this is based on two real NASCAR drivers that used to do that sort of thing.
Like what, in the 50s?
No, like probably in the 70s and 80s. Who would indiscriminately rent cars and just turn them over, completely beat to shit.
That was a Jackass skit.
Was it?
I'm having flashbacks of our father driving a Subaru Justy. being so angry that it wouldn't come out of park. Because he wouldn't put his foot on the brake. Yanking on the gears. It won't come out of park. Oh, good memories.
So, Drew, what other scenes did I yada yada?
No, not that you yada yada them. It's just that they weren't in the movie.
Ah, okay.
The scene where Rowdy and Cole became like just best friends. The scenes where Russ Wheeler turned from an aw shucks, thanks for the opportunity guy to the arch villain of racing history.
Yes.
The scene where Dr. Claire went from kind of being interested to just being completely head over heels in love with Cole and vice versa.
To the point of putting her job in jeopardy?
Yeah.
That's right.
Like, she seemingly just took a whole bunch of personal leave.
But also in those days where he could call and get her address from her employer.
That's... Well, I think you could still do that. It's not right. It's totally 100% not right.
You could not do that where I work.
You couldn't do it. But if you knew a guy who knew a guy, maybe you could, trade on favors and stuff. That the used car salesman way of doing it. Social engineering.
Yeah, it's probably still way too easy to do. But
yeah.
No. See, that would... If one of my employees did that, they would be fired.
Of course.
So.
Yeah, and we went from Randy Quaid's character to kind of being seemingly from being like Cole's like biggest champion to fuck this guy, I'm moving on. But at the end, he was still kind of with him.
Yeah, and
it was weird. Like, did Randy Quaid turn into a villain or not?
It was almost like there was some subplot that the Randy Quaid character wanted to get Michael Rooker's character out of the race because he knew that Tom Cruise's character wouldn't be able to finish a race and win, so he could then substitute Cary Elwes, which is who he really wanted.
But he theoretically he owned Cary Elwes and Tom Cruise, and Michael Rooker was his own thing. Michael Rooker had his own team, and so when Cole went to drive,
but I think that by taking Michael Rooker's character out, it opened the door for him to insert Cary Elwes as a winner because he didn't expect Tom Cruise to be able to win all that much.
Well, maybe, yeah.
So, boy, that is some deep damn analysis of this movie.
Okay, but I'm leaving the best for the end. So Cole drives into victory lane after winning the race because he went inside when they thought he was going to go outside. Spoiler. Yeah, that's you didn't see that coming a mile off.
Cole always goes outside. Always means he did it like three times, by the way.
Exactly. So he approaches Harry, who's sitting by himself, and Harry's all at a loss for words. Cole asks Harry to walk with him, and Harry agrees, but then he challenges him to a foot race and to victory lane. And this film ends on what?
Freeze frame.
Freeze frame. So, can you think of other important freeze frame endings of movies?
I think Cannonball Run.
Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club for sure. I think Cannibal Run had more like a montage, if I'm thinking about it correctly. But we're on the right track. I have The Breakfast Club. I've got pretty much every Rocky movie.
Rocky 3 was probably the best.
Yes, I think so. Where they go from freeze frame to painting.
Yes.
We've got Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2 that just freeze framed on Axel, but still, it's a freeze frame. Thelma and Louise, of course. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Course, The Color of Money, Saturday Night Fever, but maybe the most effective freeze frame ever in any movie, although I guess the 400 blows that I've never seen is apparently the first big freeze frame thing, but maybe the most effective movie ever for a freeze frame. And
I'm really excited right now.
Above Butch Cassidy, above Thelma and Louise, although I'm probably more similar to The Breakfast Club. But an essential piece of the movie. It defines this movie. Sleepaway Camp. Do you remember Sleepaway Camp?
I'm really hoping you just inserted the sound of crickets right there.
Do you guys don't remember Sleepaway Camp? Jason probably has never seen it.
Is that a slasher movie?
Yes, it is.
Nope, I do not remember.
Okay, Sleepaway Camp. Sometime when it's just you and me, Drew, we're going to watch Sleepaway Camp.
Tell me it's on Shudder.
Probably. But I think I own a copy of it. It is a seminal film.
All right.
It's got so much to talk about that's bad, but the freeze frame ending is the best thing ever. So, for Horror Etc. fans, listeners of that podcast who happen to listen to ours, certainly Dougie has seen Sleepaway Camp. I won't give it away if you haven't, but
I imagine if it was a slasher movie, you from the 80s, I assume?
Yes.
I'm sure you and I watched it together.
Yes, I'm sure we did. And there's only one thing to remember about it, and that's the freeze frame ending. But it's worth watching the whole thing because it is a batshit crazy movie. Do not give away the ending, Jason. I can see your face as you're looking at it.
No, I'm not. I'm actually looking at a list from Shudder, from Letterboxd of freeze frame ending movies.
Ah, okay.
I'm looking at some of the titles because that picture and the title they seem very...
I think Deja Vu has a freeze frame ending technically, but it's not like a Breakfast Club or Rocky freeze frame ending.
So this is the preliminary list from Letterboxd. Run Lola Run, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, Las Vegas, Freeway, Kasaba. Never seen that one. Philadelphia, Thelma and Louise, Days of Thunder, Metropolitan, Uncle Buck, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yep, well, that's more like a John Candy freeze frame.
Crocodile Dundee, At Close Range, Color of Money.
That's a good one, though.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Teen Wolf, White Knights, Vision Quest, The Breakfast Club, The Karate Kid... Trancers, Easy Money, Flashdance, Staying Alive, Rambo, Diner, Gallipoli, Dead and Buried, Officer and Gentleman, Little Darlings, I think I'm almost done with this, A Saturday Night Fever, The Omen, A Boy and His Dog, 3 Days of the Condor, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, Tulane Blacktop, Cabaret.
Oh, Electroglide in Blue has an apparently effective one.
It's a lot. Yeah. The Sword of Doom.
It's a thing. It's a trope.
Yeah.
But when I saw it, it made me smile. It was like, yeah, this is a perfect button on a perfect 80s style movie.
You guys have seen there's another Rambo movie? coming out.
Yeah, Last Blood, right?
Last Blood. That's... I'm very offended.
You think?
I understand why, but in my heart, First Blood, a movie I thought was really good, I haven't seen it in a long time, maybe it's not, but was at least far and away better as a movie than the sequels,
oh,
Rambo.
Yeah.
So,
and the title means something.
I do not like the Rambo franchise sullying the name of First Blood.
Yep, I can see. I agree with that. So, we'll go in traditional order. Brother Jay?
Mm-hmm.
Judge away.
I do not know what grade to give this movie. Part of me really just reflexively wants to fail it with a big fat F. I don't know that it was... Let's see. I'm trying to think. Was it really... I don't know. I would give it a D at best. My heart is screaming F, but my brain is saying D. But this movie was excruciating to watch. The dialogue alone of Nicole Kidman's doctor was stilted, and just there was the rest of the character's dialogue was incidental and unnecessary for the most part. Had they just had like Andy Serkis and a bunch of grunting monkeys, it probably would have been a better show. So
what I want to see more of Nicole Kidman, frankly, is I want to see more of the Nicole Kidman we saw when she told Cole to let her out of the damn car.
Yeah.
And that was a powerful scene. It was emotional.
Yeah. And then her little sexy Velociraptor T-Rex routine against the wall. Not so much.
It's not her fault that her co-star was only 4 feet 11 inches.
Well, exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, I get that.
Watching them on the motorcycle, I actually had to stop the movie because it was so hilarious to see him like all hunched down on this motorcycle and she's towering over him and back. Like she's hanging on to him like he's a 5-year-old. She's just like, no, it's okay. Keep driving.
Well, that's why the number three slot of the number three hole in the Ebert list is the superior woman who's usually older, taller, and more mature. It's like, well, the taller thing has got to be a given because there aren't a lot. I mean, I guess there are lots of short actresses, but still.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, I guess you can't always be in a movie opposite Rosie Perez to make you look taller. Anyway.
Was that a thing?
I don't know. That's the entire premise
of White Man Can't Jump.
Yeah. Well, it's because juxtaposition of size is funny. It's a comedy. Funny.
Gotcha.
So, Drew, was it worth it?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't really disagree with any of Jason's criticisms. yet... I enjoyed this movie. It's not a thinker. It's a feeler. And Robert Duvall is doing some work.
Yeah.
And a young Tom Cruise is fun. I mean, it's very formulaic. There's no chemistry between him and his future wife. But it's fun. I mean, you got... That's racing. He's just rubbing. And rubbing's racing.
When you say it's a feeler, what part of it was a feeler?
It's a feel good. It's a feel good movie. It's at what point? It's comfort food. You know what to expect. You know all the beats. It's done competently. It's shot well. It looks good. Yeah, the story's real thin. Real thin.
This is the bologna sandwich on white bread with American cheese of movies. Like, yeah, if it's what you grew up with, it's fine. You're never going to order it in a restaurant.
Except that your mother was out of bologna that day, so it was just a cheese mayonnaise sandwich that you showed up at school with.
It's not Crimson Tide. It's not Man on Fire. It's not Top Gun.
It's not even Deja Vu. There are no challenging ideas in this movie.
I think it's better than the Taking of Pelham 123.
The original or the remake?
the Tony Scott remake with John Travolta.
Yeah.
Yeah. This movie is dated and silly. But I thought it was fun. It was fun.
And I can only can echo your thoughts. Jason, you're completely right, as usual, or as mostly right. But yeah, when you were deliberating with yourself on the grade, to me, it can't be an F movie because it doesn't fail. It actually succeeds in it does everything a movie needs to do. It doesn't do it in any particularly artful way, but it doesn't hurt anybody, and it doesn't leave you with I never groaned. It was just more of I know exactly where this movie is going, and I'm happy for the ride. I'm happy for the 107 minute ride. I would not be happy with the 183 minute version of this movie.
You didn't groan when he was talking to the car.
Well, okay, I squinted my eyes and I was like, well, I also fast-forwarded through this only sex scene. So, you know, it wasn't a perfect movie.
This movie didn't have the ambition to be anything beyond what it is.
I think so. I think this was strictly a money grab, right?
Yeah. I think it was hey, nobody's made a movie about NASCAR, and NASCAR seems pretty popular right now.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But they didn't go at it. But they didn't go at it with the... with the ambition, I don't think, of making, okay, NASCAR is really popular now, so let's make the NASCAR movie. This was just strictly Top Gun in a car.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think I don't think it had any greater ambitions. I think you're absolutely right. So, is that the final thought then on Days of Thunder? I hope the parents have a great time at the NASCAR race.
Me too.
I've never been to one. I can't imagine. I think Kelly has. My wife has been to one. As all big events are, you've got event energy. So you're probably going to have a fun time. You could probably buy yourself a hot dog or some popcorn or something. And you can listen in the stands.
Probably buy yourself a hot dog.
Okay, yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Okay.
I bet they call them freedom dogs.
Exactly. Yeah, you can buy yourself a hot dog, get yourself a freedom beer, pack of Winston's. You'll be good to go.
So I posed this question to Mom.
Oh, we didn't talk about Fred Thompson. Tip one out for Fred Thompson. Anyway, go ahead. So you posed the question to Mom.
Because I was curious about this whole NASCAR thing, maybe this is a really clumsy comparison, but I posed to her this, and I said, so is Dad as to NASCAR as Grandma Marge was to McCarthy, where there is like some backstory that we've never known anything about that we're only going to find out about after he's dead? Like,
yeah,
is there
some... turns out I did hear that the US on that from them.
Oh, did they say that?
No, well, good. No, Dad was amused because he's like, yeah, there's nothing to it. it was something we could do because there wasn't a Rolling Stone concert that week or whatever.
But it just seems so out of left field. So I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't something that...
The answer was, no, I think you're reading too much into it. Also, I don't think Dad realizes the romantic view of McCarthy that some of us have.
Yeah, without any actual knowledge, because we don't talk about things like this. I have extrapolated in my own head that this was born of his kind of renewed energy around his old racing car.
Ah, yeah, there possibly. We go. That was what you were getting at, Jason?
Yeah. Well, kind of. Yes. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure that we wanted him to know we were paying attention, and B, that we wanted to make sure that if there was something else that he wanted to share, that he could, because God knows we have a family history of not saying things and then not knowing about it until it's gone. So,
well, okay, you know. Well, I was going to save this for like off air talk, but I think this will make the cut. So it did occur to me, like, so now Dad is retired. And I actually asked him the other day, I asked Dad, I said, okay, so now you're retired how do I get a hold of you? Are you going to have your cell phone with you most of the day, you think? Or you think I should call the house? Or would you like to correspond in text rather than voice? Or, you know, he's like, I'm not sure. I guess I don't really check my phone very often, but maybe I will more now. It's like, yeah, you know, before it was easy. You're at work. We contact mom, who contacts your secretary, who gets a hold of you. And then that's how we've talked for decades. So now that you will be actually maybe personally accessible if you want to, let's figure this out. Which actually, since we have talked, there's a recurring theme in our podcast and in our lives that, you know, maybe we don't have the greatest communication between fathers and sons. Not anybody in particular's fault, but, you know, we have the whole, you know, sometimes talking to one's father in America, I guess, or maybe even in the world, I don't know. Historically, it's not always the easiest thing. So I think we should, you know, it worked for my brothers. I think we should start a podcast with Dad. We could talk to him every day, every week. We can get to the heart of all these issues, you know, 1 hour at a time every week.
So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you wanna catch an episode. They talk movies, so they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's a brother Sanderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away unless you're driving. Keep them open in that case. We got Aaron, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Not in a creepy way. 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 Okay. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. We got Aaron, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.